What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to lose some pride, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, soil, to be brought down to earth, to bite the dust, to be laid low. In that sense, maybe a humbling can never actually be welcomed in as great. We would never wish for this encounter with mortality on a planetary scale, but here we are. If this is a humbling, then maybe it's about a regrounding, a reconnection in which we are being made to stare into the dark mirror and reflect on the reflection we see staring back at us. Perhaps there's a message in that image. My name's Ed Gillespie, and myself and my co-host Dougald Hine have spent the last 20 years trying to decipher and articulate that message. How will they look in hindsight, these strange times we are living through? Is this a midlife crisis on humanity's road to the Star Trek future, or the point at which that story of the future unraveled and we came to see how much it had left out? What if our current crises are neither an obstacle to be overcome, nor the end of the world, but a necessary humbling? In the early weeks of the coronavirus crisis and the extraordinary rupture of the everyday that it represents, we set out to explore what it means to be humbled.
Here we are then, Ed. It's week six of this series, and it's six of eight. We kind of decided that we know roughly where we are in the arc of this for now. We'll see. We're calling today's episode As Deep as Culture, and we'll get into why that seemed like a subject to dig at. Ed, you told me about something you've been reading this week that feels like a route into that.
Yes, and inevitably, as Dr. Martin Shaw is one of the people that we have in common over the last few years, I often find myself gravitating back towards Martin's writing. And I hesitate to say Martin's hairpiece, because that seems to make a reference.
Sounds like a merkin.
Yeah. it did. Actually, there is actually, in Martin's recording of Parsifal, he does actually mistake a merkin for a jerkin at one point, when he's referring to an item of clothing, and he goes, "I don't mean merkin, do I?" But no, Martin's hairpiece, so it's not a reference to his head, it is a beautiful sort of Easter piece he shared called a hare's leap or a rabbit's hop. It was a typically stirring offering that sort of bristles with energy and soul and backbone. What Martin describes in it, he says, culture is being forced to leap at this moment, but we run grievous risk of a rabbit hop back to safety, not a hare leap into the deeper life. And it's a fairly gristly piece of writing in some ways. It's got quite a lot of sort of natural violence of hare fighting off a hawk, which is trying to take its young, and the battling and the boxing of hares, almost, you know, kicking each other to death. But what really stuck with me was the way he describes the sort of hare energy. And I'm quoting it here. He said, "He nags and pulls and bites until something vast is happening to us. We are dragged into the presence of strange angels, and so pathetically grateful we can only weep in this chapel perilous." And for hare, the chapel perilous is the fecund state of that changeable dimension we gesture to and dimly call our heart. Perilous is it when the animal presences are absent, when there's no sweet stink of the low-bellied spirits. Hare will clamp his buck teeth straight into the beating organ, swinging back and forth like a lunatic pirate on the rigging, in the most Machiavellian storm of most trembling imaginations, till we are out the door, into the night, into the storm, into the rain. And I sort of read that and I was like, ooh, that's a pretty Easter type of reading that I need. And as Martin says, you know, as artists and people in culture are waiting to get leapt, not rabbit hop back to safety, but to make those big leaps. And it just took me back to what you were saying last week about hares.
Yeah. Do you know, I don't think I had ever actually seen a hare before I moved to Sweden. And wow. When Martin writes about them in the English landscape, they feel like these kind of wild avatars of something very old. And now I look out of my window. It's happened even more since I talked about it on last week's episode. And I see them all the time. They're a part of this urban landscape here in Västerås. And it's been quite strange being in Sweden in the middle of all this. I guess that's one of the things I wanted to talk about this week, and we'll get into that more later. But just literally at the beginning of April, we were moving house while most of my friends who I was talking to in other countries could barely leave their homes. So here we are having this conversation, and it's a conversation between two guys who have lots of things in common. We tick the same demographic boxes in a whole bunch of ways, and we're inhabiting two quite different realities because, you know, I got up this morning and my partner cycled off to take our son to kindergarten, and then she goes into the office and she's actually working with the crisis management team for the city here. So it's not like the pandemic doesn't impinge on our lives. But I realize, especially as the weeks go by and I talk to friends in England and the days and weeks of lockdown have built up, quite how far apart our lives are drifting at that level of the everyday. And it's really, I have really complicated, mixed feelings about that.
And it's funny, but there's also elements which have been sort of strangely in common, aren't there? You know, when you, I was reading your piece, your final piece of Clarity for Teachers, when you had that wonderful passage about the magpie, and it was one of those moments I went, oh, I had a total sort of flicker of recognition, because just that morning my 5-minute poem had also referenced the flash of blue beneath the black and white of the magpie. And I think we both realized then that was an image that was probably planted in us by Martin Shaw, when he always said, when people are having difficulty in a relationship, he always tells them to go and look at magpies, because if they think the bird is just black and white, they're mistaken. And it's only when they've caught the kind of secretive flash of blue feather under the wing that they realise that things are rarely binary.
It's an image that's working in us, isn't it? And yeah, that was quite uncanny that we'd both landed on it without knowing on the same day this week. Maybe it's an image for what we're trying to do in these conversations, to treat the bits that don't fit into the black and white mapping of the world, and the black and white ways of telling stories and setting up debates, to treat that as the bit that matters most, the bit that might unlock the puzzle.
And I also listened to a great interview with Margaret Atwood, with Cheryl Strayed, and her new podcast, Sugar Calling. And I don't know if you've read any of the Dear Sugar writings.
I wouldn't have
intuitively put them on your reading list. But essentially, it's like,
I'm going to have to read them now, aren't I?
Well, there's one or two that are really quite incredible. But it's like agony aunt life advice that comes with the recommendation you get lept. They're really quite profound, some of them, in terms of their heartfelt and raw life experience laden type of thinking. But she had a really great discussion with Margaret Atwood, and particularly about how this sort of 80-year-old writer has dug out her sewing machine to make masks, and her life in lockdown. And Margaret talked a lot about eldership, and what it's like at 80 to have lost many of your confidence and friends and family. And then she said something beautiful, which again really connected with me, which is saying, but they're still with you, the conversation is just very one-sided. She goes, oh, yeah, and that, you know, having lost my dad and my brother, that really connected with me, because yes, you can have the conversation, but you can't have the pint together. But that doesn't mean that their thinking and their perspective isn't with you. And then the other thing that Margaret said, obviously she's known for her environmental activism, and she's written some pretty great pieces on climate and hope. But she then referenced a guy called Barry Lord, who I'd not come across before. And he's the co-founder of Lord Cultural Resources, I think with his partner, which is an international museum planning consultancy. And he had a book out a few years ago, which is called Art and Energy, How Culture Changes. And Atwood described this book, you know, quite intriguingly, as if it had been quite influential on her and her thinking. And in it, Barry describes how the dominant energy system of the day defines the culture and its actions and values. and the energy transitions are by their very nature, therefore, culture wars, and really gets into this dynamic of how a particular energy system and culture are completely intertwined and interdependent. And he takes the reader on a narrative journey where obviously it starts with wood and firewood, where it's all about access to land and forest and the importance of forest and the feudal relationships that come from securing the access to that energy. And then there's coal and the culture of production that comes from that, and the Industrial Revolution and the need for massive manpower and organization in order to extract, burn and create the machine that we've touched on before. And then he almost argues that oil and gas led to a culture of consumption, where you, the culture of production of coal moves to a culture of consumption because oil and gas is relatively easier in terms of manpower to extract. It's not quite as intensive as coal. And so you have to, the attention of the culture then works out other ways to use that energy. And then electricity is the culture of modernism. He even goes in a sort of sidetrack around nuclear power being connected to a culture of anxiety and fear and a certain degree of uncertainty of forces beyond our control. And lastly, he sort of brings it round quite beautifully to the idea that, you know, renewable energy is all about a culture of stewardship, which by its very nature then threatens, obviously, a culture of consumption or production. And so those threats to identity are what leads to these culture wars. And actually, renewables start to repudiate those identities which are inextricably connected with consumption and modernism. I thought that was a really, really quite beautiful framing of the interdependencies between cultures and sources of energy.
Yeah, that's quite a map, isn't it? Sort of story about the interrelation between the material and the technological and the cultural. And that last bit about renewables made me think of the debates that are still rumbling, or kind of something bigger and louder than fierier than rumbling, around Planet of the Humans and a few pieces that I read this week that are kind of trying to salvage the difficult, important part of the message from the things that might be problematic about that film. And so I can feel in me a little bit of resistance to the story of renewables as rescuing us from or turning us aside from industrial culture and industrial society and the things that it's produced. But it's... You get a story like that, a map like that, and it gives you a space in which to have a conversation. It's what I love about the social cartographies that Vanessa Andreotti and the others in the Decolonial Futures Collective work with, is that they're maps which very clearly, you know, don't say this is just how it is, this is the only way you could draw a map of this territory. And by foregrounding that, they become a meeting point where you can have more difficult conversations that get beyond the black and white. I was thinking about this question of culture and, you know, what's culture got to do with a pandemic? And I think it was Daniel Schmachtenberger who I heard saying, a virus doesn't care about your stories. Doesn't care about what story you tell about the world.
Which is an echo of the facts don't care about your feelings piece, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And, you know, there's something in that that really resonates with me. And I talked back at the beginning of these conversations about experiencing this strange reluctance as someone who works with stories to throw a narrative around the raw experience of this collective encounter with mortality that's going on. But there's another part of me that wants to push back against that, because there's a story that is very powerful that's been around in modern Western culture and been very influential, which says that culture itself is a kind of soft surface layer over the harder, realer aspects of reality. You know, it's kind of a luxury or a comfort blanket, or a thing that we use to distract ourselves from the hard lessons that our encounters with things like something as physical as a rock or something as biological as a virus bring when we collide with them. And so you could get from that a picture of something like this pandemic as kind of tearing through the illusions of culture and placing us all in this kind of bare biological condition of vulnerability, in which it doesn't matter what language you speak or what story you tell. All that matters is what this virus is doing in your body. And it's not that simple. And maybe this is where, I think this is where the conversation about the difference between the response in Sweden and the response in Britain and elsewhere comes in, which is that, yes, you can abstract and study the virus as an entity outside of the cultural, but you can't have the virus existing within the world we live in outside of the cultural, because we can't exist outside culture. We live within culture in the same way that we live within homes or tents or caves. It's the kind of shelter of meaning that we find and construct out of the world in which we find ourselves. And you kind of can't get deeper than culture. And I think this is where the strangeness of living between two cultures, even two cultures which superficially look really quite similar to each other, like Sweden and Britain. We all tend to be quite whitish. If our ancestors come from these parts of the world, we tend to be a little bit kind of reticent in talking about emotions. And we tend to, Swedes like the British sense of humour a lot and so on. It's like, I always say the culture shock for me over the last 8 years, as I've got used to making my home in Sweden, is not the kind of jarring psychedelic culture shock that I had when I was in my 20s and I lived in China for a while. It's more like when you kind of come downstairs in the middle of the night and it's dark and you've kind of miscounted the number of steps, and you get that jarring when you get to the bottom and you think you're going to step onto the whole floor and instead there's one more step. It's these strange little moments. Since kind of early March, when it began to become clear that this coronavirus thing wasn't just something that was happening somewhere else and that we were seeing out of the corner of our eye, once it became very real and present, for a while it was the hardest time that I've had of living here, because I was stuck between these two very different public conversations, between what my friends in the UK were talking about and how they were seeing and making sense of what was going on and what ought to be done, and the kind of political debates and so on, and this completely different thing here, which to a lot of people, and frankly especially a lot of non-Swedes living in Sweden, or a lot of in wanderers like me, as opposed to those who've been kind of bred into being Swedish from birth, it could feel like there was a huge complacency in the approach that Sweden has been taking. We don't have lockdown in the same sense that everybody else has. There's a lot more freedom. There's a lot more sense of normality going on here. And I remember reading this sort of that first Thomas Pueyo piece that went viral, where it's all about understanding the logic of the exponentials and how, if we don't have lockdown, this is how it's going to snowball. But what I saw was other British or American friends on Facebook trying to explain this to their Swedish friends, trying to say, look, there needs to be a change of policy. This is going to be disastrous. And what struck me at the time was how comfortable my fellow Swedes seemed to be with their country taking a different path to everyone else. You know, this was before we could see how it was playing out and who was right. But it was just very striking that there's a kind of quiet exceptionalism that's part of this culture. You know, it's a lot less in your face than American exceptionalism, let's say. But it's very much there. And I remember wondering, is this some kind of deep cultural memory of World War II neutrality, in the sense that the rest of Europe can be in chaos and devastation, and even, you know, Denmark and Norway gets invaded and Finland is busy having the winter war and all of the rest of it, and Sweden gets to sit it out? And is that operating at a kind of deep level within the political culture here that people almost aren't aware of, making it possible to make this different set of decisions? Is the scar of the 1990s crisis that was hit Sweden very, very hard in its economy, is that what's kind of guiding the policymaking? It was incredibly striking to me when the Prime Minister here went on TV in the middle of March and gave a speech to the nation, which just doesn't happen. That's not how Swedish political culture works. He said, lives, health and jobs are under threat, kind of grouping the economic damage and the human casualties together in a way that, you know, if Boris Johnson or Donald Trump comes out with something that seems to place that as an equation, lots of people are absolutely up in arms. And like, you know, this is the horror of neoliberalism, equating the economy with this much more real thing of human lives. And it's so interesting to see that, you know, a social democratic prime minister here in this society, matter-of-factly speaking in that language. And one thing that I've heard people say is that there's this sense of welfare in which the economy is bound up with the state's ability to provide for people, that means that there is a much more widely shared consensus that what happens to the economy is good for everybody or bad for everybody than how it feels in Britain, where, you know, the good times for the economy haven't been felt by large parts of the northeast of England where I grew up for, you know, decades. So that must be part of it. I don't know. I mean, Ed, I've been sort of freewheeling here about what might be specific about the way that things are playing out in Sweden. But what do you see being in the middle of it all in Britain and, you know, coming from Britain?
Well, there's a couple of things that just occurred to me while you were talking. One is that, you know, the culture of individualism in the States is manifest through he who shall not be named in the White House, you know, where actually the response to the virus is all about re-election. Or, you know, these knee-jerk quack cures of injecting bleach and some kind of miracle cure, because getting the economy back on track is exactly the priority, and almost never mind the carnage or the mess created in the process. And equally, I live in an Anglo-Italian household, and so it's been fascinating and horrifying initially, you know, watching the lockdown happened in Italy ahead of what happened here. And so being sort of prepared for that in advance a little bit. But also when Lombardy region was locked down initially, you know, the Italian cultural response was literally to flee, almost to kind of get in their cars and everyone drive to their second homes or go and visit relatives elsewhere, which obviously therefore completely undermines. And I wonder whether that's because, you know, Italian culture is highly regional. You know, the idea of Italy as a national culture and a nation state is a relatively recent phenomenon. But in terms of the UK, it's a slightly paradoxical response, I guess. I mean, there is the deference, which is one aspect of the British psyche. And once we were locked down, we've been relatively obedient. We haven't had to have the super strict constraints that my friends in Italy and Spain have experienced, basically the fear of arrest to keep people in their homes. We've had some classic sort of British busybody type of behaviours, with police putting black dye in a blue lagoon reservoir in Derbyshire to deter swimmers on lockdown, and filming people with drones. But there has been a sort of general acceptance, I guess, in respect of authority. I would say that's creaking a little now. I live on Brixton Hill, so I can sense and see the traffic has definitely picked up again in the last week or 10 days.
I can hear the traffic noise in the background compared to previous weeks when we've been recording.
Exactly. So there you go. That's a pretty audible shift. So there is this part of the British mentality of acceptance and respect of authority, which is maybe why we keep electing old Etonians. And on the other side of it is, as you were saying, a sort of Swedish exceptionalism. I think there is a British exceptionalism. There's lots of that blitz spirit and war metaphor stuff that we discussed in episode 4. And even the Prime Minister's lucky escape, you know, whilst being tended by an international team of care workers. This was sort of spun into his indomitable strength of character, as if grit, determination and a stiff upper lip defined your survival chances, you know, rather than far more prosaic mixture of luck, lifestyle and dedicated medical care. But one other thought I had, actually, was I read a piece comparing coronavirus atmospheric transmission, so not the direct person-to-person transmission that all the physical distancing is trying to tackle, but the atmospheric transmission, comparing it to cholera outbreaks in London in the 1850s, where, you know, when I used to drink in the John Snow pub on Broadwick Street in Soho, I became fascinated with the story of Dr. John Snow, who mapped the cases and identified the origins of the cholera outbreak to a contaminated water pump, you know, which was the source of the infection. Now, previously, people had thought cholera was caused by bad air. So it was the sort of contact tracing of its day, which is what we're all obviously talking about now. But it really challenged the orthodoxy. And even afterwards, you know, authorities continued to reject John Snow's argument as the cause being this connection of between the oral and the rather distasteful fecal contamination of the water was deemed both too unpleasant for the public to comprehend, but also too disruptive to a city which just didn't have any sewage or sanitation really to speak of, which raised a couple of thoughts, which I think firstly we love and celebrate mavericks after the fact, usually after they're dead. And where it's going now is, I think, the increasing evidence of the links between atmospheric pollution, especially these particulates, which come from exhaust fumes in urban areas, and the link between that and coronavirus transmission. Now, this is some preliminary work, but most outbreaks seem to occur in heavily polluted areas. And, you know, like we're saying, I live on one of the dirtiest streets in the country. So people are now saying, do we need to stop the pollution to stop this atmospheric transmission of the virus? Or if business is going to open back up, does it need to clean up before it's allowed to open back up? And I think there's something quite profound in the fact that globally aviation spread this virus around the world over distance really quickly. But local transmission may be via, you know, a smoggy breath. And for both, there is literally something in the air. And both of which are awkward signals for any return to normal of either aviation or urban traffic. And I think there's something here in this sort of the maverick science and our complex relationship with mavericks. It also made me think, you know, on the flip side of that sort of maverick piece, how much we also in Britain and in other parts of the world obviously love a bit of mad maverick conspiracy theory too, which conversely maybe comes from a counterpart rejection of that authority and deference and respect for institutions. You know, half of the UK thinks coronavirus is created in a Chinese lab. 20% are vaccine suspicious, and almost 10% of people think it's caused by 5G telecoms networks, you know, which is why these 5G masks are being attacked for spreading corona. And interestingly, Brexiteers are also more likely to believe all of these things than Remainers. So there is this sort of countercultural current as well. So not all mavericks are credible.
Not all stories are helpful. Not all maps are a good fit for the territory. And there's a sense in which we don't have any good maps for the territory that we're in. It's not just the conspiracy theory maps that are deeply misleading and dangerous in some cases. Actually, you know, even the kind of official maps are pretty damn misleading. There's this sense of, well, lockdown will come to an end and things will begin to get back to normal. And we don't know what the end of this event looks like. We don't know what comes after it looks like, but back to normal is a pretty improbable direction of travel from here.
How is it looking now in Sweden is the question that then comes onto my lips.
It depends who you ask, really. I mean, if you look at the numbers, Sweden has had more casualties than the other Nordic countries that followed more of a lockdown approach. What it doesn't have is the kind of exponential rise in deaths that is meant to be what happens if you don't have a lockdown, according to those really influential Thomas Puyo Medium posts and so on. So I'm not saying that Sweden has got it right and everyone else has got it wrong, but it has been a bit humbling for me, you know, having been really, I remember walking around with this struggle inside me between what everybody in the English-speaking world that I'm kind of connected to was saying about what this is, what we need to do, etc., and where the public debate was at in Sweden. And after about 3 days of this, I was like, I just have to stop carrying it and staging it as a drama inside my chest, because I'm not an epidemiologist. I can't even say it. I'm not going to influence the policy making or change anything. All that staging that drama in my head and in my chest and walking around with it all day does is make me difficult to live with. So that was a humbling moment of going, okay, I have to just put that down and be where I am. And actually, maybe that's like part of the learning for me about what it really means to have settled here and made this my home, is that I have to live within this environment, this cultural environment, this political and social environment. And yes, I can get involved with that and try and shape it, but I can't shape it by standing, you know, imagining that I have some ground to stand on outside of it.
Yeah, and why do you think it has played out so differently in Sweden?
So, I mean, I guess part of the question is, why hasn't it turned into the apocalypse that a few weeks ago, you know, a lot of people I know were literally saying, you know, it's going to be horrific in Sweden. And yeah, I think that the cultural factors are part of that, would be my guess. Right. When other Brits come to Sweden and they're trying to get their bearings, I always say, you know, look, watch some Swedish detective shows and some British detective shows, and you'll begin to grasp the difference. You talked about deference in British culture, and of course that's there, and it's deference and marked hierarchy. And so all of the British detective shows, you always have, you know, an inspector and a sergeant. So there's a hierarchy between the two of them at the center of the story. And then below them, you'll have more junior detectives and uniformed officers. And above them, you'll have the kind of big bosses within the police force. And, you know, lots of the tension and the drama will revolve around the playing out of power within that, and how the maverick inspector gets summoned into his boss's office. It's like, you're off the case, Morse. And then you watch a Swedish detective series and you have Wallander sitting around a table with all of his colleagues who are involved in the case, and they're all drinking coffee and they're having a discussion about what they should do next. And then in the next scene, he's off in a corner next to the photocopier talking to his old friend about, you know, how difficult it is with these young officers who don't do the things that he's asked them to do. And it's almost as though you've got deference without the explicit power, you know, mechanisms of hierarchy. We had a friend who works at a Swedish university and who's been here for a year or so and comes from the UK, who came and visited us, and we all went for a walk together the other weekend because we can still do that. And we were talking about the weirdness of being Brits here in Sweden. I was telling a story about how when they were recruited, the person who recruited them actually tried to persuade me to come and be their assistant. And my friend just laughed and said, wow, it would be great to have an assistant. I have these two lovely young people whose job it is to work with me in one way or another, but there's nobody who's my assistant. There's nobody I can tell to do anything. I was like, oh yeah, welcome to Sweden, where no one can tell anyone to do anything. And actually a little bit of this kind of clicked at that point. So I was like, oh, right. You know, that's part of the difference in how Sweden has been approaching all of this, is if you really have a kind of culture in which things don't get done by somebody telling somebody else what to do, there has to be a more indirect mechanism. Have you ever seen those charts of like meeting dynamics and decision-making processes in different cultures?
No, but I'm visualizing them already.
it's been like a meme online in the last 10 years or so at some point, but it comes from a book that was done in the 90s by this old guy who's been like a management expert and a linguist. And they all have these kind of sets of lines that are kind of tracking alongside each other. And there'll be certain points where they cross. There'll be bits written underneath or above that are like advice for how to handle it. But the Swedish one looks totally different because the lines get like halfway through the decision-making process and then just come to a stop. And then you get this one curling line, like a sort of snail trail going round in circles. And then out of the far side of it emerges some kind of new consensus. And it's almost like if you didn't grow up with this, you can't even read it. You can't even see it. So I've wondered to what extent it's not that everybody else has gone into lockdown and Sweden's had this very laissez-faire approach. It's that the way in which behaviour change is communicated within Swedish culture is through a more understated way of communicating what you need to do. And so actually there has been a lot of change in people's behaviours, and the way that people are living their lives here hasn't been as extreme as what we've seen in the UK. But then, as you say, what we've seen in the UK hasn't been as extreme as what you've seen in Spain or Italy. And maybe that's, you know, effective by using channels that are almost invisible to people who aren't deeply part of this culture. So that's sort of one of my suspicions about, you know, rather than it being that we get to the point where we have a few more weeks and, you know, the curve continues to drop here and people go, well, everywhere else could have done what Sweden has done. Maybe not. You know, maybe that's some combination of cultural factors and environmental factors, very clean air. You know, social distancing might just be an accurate description of how things work in Sweden. Anyway, we have more one-person households than anywhere else. I am certain that we have more people who don't see their elderly parents from one month to the next than almost anywhere else, because there is just this assumption that you have a kind of a system that takes care of people, and therefore you are not, you're not dependent on each other in your family relationships in the way that is the case almost anywhere else.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's a couple of things that makes me think. So firstly, there's a sort of like a collective trust or an understanding or an expectation that things will unfold in a certain way. And partly maybe that helps you to deal with a degree of uncertainty, because I think, you know, we often tend to want to go back to the familiar. Again, I think we've touched on this in a previous session. But where we're going in terms of leadership, if I was to try and extrapolate what you're saying from the Swedish insight, is like, how do we grasp leadership where actually leaders right now are having to constantly revise what they say? And it's a bit like the spiral you've just been describing, because as new evidence emerges, you need new guidance, and sometimes it's contradictory, and then you're actually having to go back on something or do a U-turn on something which seemed quite clear the week before, which is now no longer the case. And I think this is actually a time in which deeply held beliefs can turn out to be completely wrong. I spoke to a senior leader at a major UK business this week who told me how pre-crisis they just completed a major restructuring of their organisation before all of this kicked off. And they'd sort of spent an absolute fortune, huge cost, bringing the whole core team of thousands of employees together on two main sites. And they'd sold all this into the board, you know, on the kind of the benefits of co-working and productivity. And now, post-crisis, they've actually discovered that when everyone's remote working, productivity's actually gone up. And they've almost got to go back to the board and give a completely contradictory message of what they said just 2 years ago and say, you know that thing that we talked about before? Well, actually, it turns out that the opposite is true.
Oops.
Oops. Exactly. And so I think leadership right now feels a lot more like holding the space for vulnerability, but being really honest and able to admit that we don't know what something else is here, and having that permission not to be the heroic leader with all the answers all the time. The thing that brought that home to me even more was actually there was a pretty good letter that was out yesterday, I think, from the CEO of Airbnb. Obviously, it was a pretty difficult CEO letter. There's quite a few of them flying around at the moment. I've got to write to everyone in my organization and explain why we're laying off 25% of our staff, thousands of people. He said, we don't know when travel will return, and when it does, it will be different. So no back to normal. This is really embracing a very different future. And what he seemed to allude to, which I thought was perhaps the most heartening piece, and as you would say, this is just a clue. This is not proof. But he said, you know, we've got to get back to the idea of human connection, of what we first founded our organization on, which was real people in real homes, hosting each other and that very innate human notion of hospitality. And arguably, you know, Airbnb completely lost that. You know, they were absolutely a disaster. They just became another space renting agency, another holiday home site, and worse with the sort of hotels and luxury options. And some of the good things that the CEO has done is obviously they've made every departing employee a shareholder, allowed them to keep their laptops and their healthcare and retraining and job search. But for me, reading his letter, it felt like a humbling, you know, about them having to go right back to basics in a really humble fashion and say, we started this business on the notion of being able to travel like a human. And in the future, that looks like it's going to be much more localized, you know, much less flippant and fly by night. And we've got to get back to what real human connection at the heart of that understanding of hospitality means.
There's so much depth there if you start digging into what it might really mean to travel like a human. Mm. I mean, when we started a school called Home and we made the invitation to our first course in Sweden, we knew that we would have people who were wanting to make journeys from a long way away to be here. And we wrote on the website, think twice about flying. And actually, we thought twice about making those kinds of invitations to courses that attract people to make the journey where you get on a plane from the other side of the world to come here and be part of this small school. And one of the threads that's run on from that with some of the people who were part of that first course is about what close to the ground travel might mean. Like, how does culture cross boundaries in a time where we can't just be hopping on and hopping off planes as if there's no tomorrow? I mean, Ed, I know you like wrote the book about traveling without flying, but there's something deeper in that once you start to look at it in terms of the way that a whole world, like the culture sector, let's say, organizes itself, because you realize how much of that travel involves people going to a city without even being there. Like, you get to the airport, you get to the hotel, you get to the place where you're meeting lots of other people who've come from different cities around the world. You spend the day together, you give your talk at the thing, and then you go back to the airport and get on the plane home. And it's not just that it's utterly unsustainable, it's also quite shit, frankly. And there have to be more human ways of traveling. And so we've had this idea that we've been sort of seeding for ages of this thing called the Silk Road. So you might have an artist who's setting off from Doncaster, and over the course of a month, using an Interrail pass, they are making their way to somewhere in central Sweden and then back again. And every couple of days, they move on to another place and they're hosted by somebody locally, and they are that month's guest at a monthly event that happens that also has contributions from people who live in that town or city or village. And in this way, over the course of a year, you would have 12 artists who make that journey. They make a decent living out of the events they do on those month-long tours, and they kind of contribute to the weaving together of something that is both local and connected over distance. I think there's something that's kind of more beautiful and more meaningful in that than a lot of the ways that we organize culture and travel at the moment. But it starts from somewhere utterly different to the where our existing institutions start from.
It's like following, it's what William Stafford would say, is following the thread. I love the Silk Road as thread, which is kind of what you're alluding to, rather than the sort of chopped up sections that we might actually experience in a sort of more commoditized way. And maybe the conclusion for this particular episode is around this idea of needing to be broken, you know, in the way that perhaps the CEO of Airbnb has had to feel, either by what Martin would say, by beauty or by truth. And I think, you know, in some ways, from a British perspective, we're sort of resistant to being broken by either. We're resistant to being broken by the beauty of the rewilding and the things we've talked about in terms of the resurgent spring nature that's been revealed to us. And somehow that beauty is not enough to create the resistance to a return to so-called normality. And equally, we're a bit resistant to the truth of the virus, calling into question some of the fundamental cultural stories we tell ourselves.
So much of this is about, like, what would it cost to know what it really means to travel like a human, or to live like a human? We've been in these societies that have been addicted to this kind of upward sweeping trajectory of progress and growth and development. And we know, you and I know from the work we've been doing, and actually lots of other people know, it's like a quarter of an inch below the surface of our whole culture, how unsustainable that is, how impossible it is to just kind of reboot that trajectory where the whole of history is building to the rocket ships taking off. But what's harder is to get oriented to what might take the place of that. I guess, you know, I mentioned last week, and we've launched it now, we're running this course, an online course called Homeward Bound, which starts next Thursday evening and is really about reorienting ourselves, turning for home, and what that might mean. You mentioned Martin talking about getting broken. I remember talking to him after we'd held our first course here in Sweden, and him saying, look, you know, you run a school like this, you know, people are going to be broken open by these kinds of conversations, this kind of work, and you can either break them with beauty or you can break them with truth. But something else he says somewhere, we won't have a story worth telling until we see a culture broken open by its consequences. And frankly, that applies every bit as much here in Sweden as it does in the UK. It applies more the further up those sweeping curves of progress and growth and development you are or think you are as a culture. And I don't know whether this thing that is unfolding that begins with the coronavirus pandemic and spreads into all sorts of other consequences, I don't know whether that is the consequence that Martin's talking about there. I don't think any of us knows yet. It's like that bit from the end of King Lear. Is this the promised end or image of that horror? We don't know yet, but what we do know is that consequences are coming. And what I've experienced in conversations over recent weeks is, among all of the different things that are happening as a result of this crisis, there is, for a lot of people, more space to talk about and grapple with and try and make sense of that than there has been. So let's use that space as best we can.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. These are astonishing times to be living in, times in which many things are revealed, uncovered, brought into a new light. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription, a provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with, and needs a little time and space to breathe. This is an unscripted conversation, a wandering, if you will. And as Tolkien said, not all those who wander are lost. We plan this as a series of informal and roving conversations as we all adventure into uncharted internal and external territories. For us, daring to dream beyond the current urgency does not dismiss or disrespect it. Rather, it honours it. Whether we like it or not, our futures are already being decided today. Please do comment, ask questions and respond. You can find us on Facebook at The Great Humbling. This is initiation at a cultural scale. Please come and join us on this emergent journey.